This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Ukraine. Headlines in these last hours. Secretary of State Antony Blinken heading to Ukraine as potential Russian invasion looms. Associated Press in these last hours. Russia moves more troops westward amid Ukraine tensions. From NATO, risk of conflict in Ukraine crisis is real. We could go on, but the headlines all point to a crisis atmosphere as we've seen these last days in the new year. There is also a report of Russian warships in the Baltic Sea moving towards the exit. There is also reporting that the Russian embassy in Kiev is lightening its staff. There is also reporting on videos that are available on YouTube of tearful farewells at train stations between Russian military personnel and their families. All this adds up to question mark. I welcome Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President of Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo during the Trump administration, who traveled these trails, Moscow, Kiev, and others, because the Trump administration inherited the unsolved conflict in Ukraine. The Obama administration inherited from the Bush administration the unsolved conflict in Georgia. All of this adds up to the Russian Federation making claims that it is under attack by NATO since 1997-1998, as NATO moved its membership closer and closer till now it's on the Russian frontier. Mary, a very good day to you. These headlines point to either the Russians are ready to move, depending upon orders from the Kremlin, or this is an elaborate bluff. I don't bluff when I play poker. I don't think the Russians bluff when they play chess. What is your measure of these odd reports from the Baltic Sea to Washington to train stations in Russia? Good day to you, Mary.
Good day to you, John. Thanks for having me on. I think what you're seeing is a flurry of phone calls and conferences and talking between the United States, Europe, and Ukraine, and a lot of acting by Russia, physically moving assets, taking their people out of their embassy, moving troops and other types of weaponry to various borders, announcing joint exercises with Belarus. And I think the contrast here is very, very striking, because talking is fine so far as it goes, but if it's not backed up with any real threat of hard power, then I don't think it's going to dissuade Vladimir Putin from doing anything. And right now, he is the one setting the agenda.
The State Department sending its representatives, led by Secretary Blinken, to Kiev to discuss what? What happens in a meeting that cannot be done on the telephone or with subordinates in these last days? After all, Mr. Zelensky has asked for a three-way conversation with President Biden and President Putin. So what is it that the secretary can achieve in these events?
Well, face-to-face meetings allow for an exchange of information, whether it be on military movements or intelligence assessments or assurances that if X happens, we will do Y. I think it's obviously incredibly important that the Ukrainians are involved as much as possible in these discussions. Zelensky has largely been sidelined. I think that that's a mistake. If you really respect Ukraine's sovereignty and want to bolster their democracy, well, then you ought to expect the wishes of their people and talk to Ukraine's elected leadership. But just this morning, in the readout that the State Department put out, it details Secretary Blinken speaking with Lavrov and talking about various meetings that they were held last week, the Strategic Stability Dialogue, the NATO-Russia Council, the OECD Permanent Council meetings, you know, talking. Why is he talking to the Russians? If the Russians are making provocative moves, then we should be talking to the Ukrainians, not the Russians. We should be laying down what our red lines are and what our interests clearly are. And if our interest is really to fulfill the commitments that, by the way, we made back in 1994 to Ukraine under the Budapest Memorandum, that we would provide security assurances and respect their sovereignty, then we need to start shipping a lot of weapons immediately to allow the Ukrainians to defend themselves, if that's really what we want. Otherwise, all of these various dialogues and meetings and conferences and phone calls, it's meaningless.
Follow the money. Washington follows Hollywood, and I follow both. And we come to the most significant tell in the Financial Times in these last hours. Moscow's sanction-proofing efforts weaken Western threat. Subhead, while Russia has stress-tested its economy and built up reserves, Europe has not reduced its energy dependence. Mary, you and I have looked at this chart, and Vladimir Putin is a very good Leningrad peasant. He has built up an enormous reserve. Central bank reserves have soared more than 70% since late 2015 and now surpassed $620 billion, including a lot of gold, 16.4% of his reserves are dollars, 13.1% are renminbi, 21.7% are in gold. The Financial Times is telling Europe that Moscow is ready for conflict. Europe is not. Is that an issue for the U.S. to settle, Mary, that our European allies in the EU and in NATO are not prepared to weather this storm?
Well, there are a lot of interesting angles here and ironies. First, that the monetary profligacy of the Federal Reserve by holding interest rates too low for too long and blowing out the Fed's balance sheet devalues the dollar and sends investors into safe havens like gold. So if Putin has been squirreling away gold, the actions of our Federal Reserve have simply increased his wealth as investors rush into commodities like gold. Secondly, the fact that Russia's reserves are not single digits, but 13.1% in renminbi speaks to the slow but sure adoption of the renminbi as a reserve currency in the major central banks around the world. And this has been facilitated by the Bretton Woods institutions, which sanctioned the renminbi several years back for just this purpose. And that's important because, as you know, John, commodities are largely traded in dollars. But what if someday that changed and we no longer held reserve status? And Russia and China could simply trade in each other's currencies, or maybe they use cryptocurrencies. This has a third implication, which is the adoption of cryptocurrency as a medium of exchange between rogue nations. That's something that the Treasury Department has worried about under Republican and now a Democrat administration. It's a real thing. So our sanctions power is a tool that has been wielded for many, many years. But one has to wonder, will it always be so effective? Is it simply a crutch that we rely on? Or is that power going to wane over time? And should we be thinking differently if we want to contain provocative situations like the one that Putin has created on the Ukraine border?
The Kremlin's been preparing for something like an invasion from Mars for several years. The Financial Times also reports that since 2017, Russia has created a national wealth fund that merges its reserve fund with the national wealth fund. And it notes here that surging oil prices have climbed beyond Russia's budgetary break-even price of $43. I believe I saw the number 87 in these last hours. And Goldman Sachs is speculating $100 by summertime. So the government is reeling in cash from the price of oil. And at the same time, Russia, according to the Financial Times, has learned to not depend on foreign investors. Foreign ownership of Russian government bonds has dropped to 20%. Mary, this is a very careful preparation for Russia detaching itself from the dollar, from even the SWIFT. You saw that the threat of kicking Russia out of the SWIFT banking protocols has been withdrawn, and consultation with the Europeans saying it would destabilize the economies of Europe as well. We're looking at Russia, if sanctioned to the extent that some have speculated, Mary, crashing the Western economies because of that spike in oil, which is already apparent. I have to believe that some of the movement of oil has to do with the risk of Russian actions. So, Mary, when did it become too late to stop this? What is your measure, Mary? You were there at the State Department. Was the understanding that Russia would not accelerate? Was the understanding that we can talk to them? Where did this come from, that we were watching Russia build up its reserves while Europe was hoping Russia kept the natural gas flowing?
Well, this is another irony of the situation, right? In that by attacking coal in the U.S. energy industry, in fact, there was news just in these last days that large hunks of Alaska will be walled off from exploration by the Biden administration. We are handing a win to Putin because we no longer control and influence the oil price. It's OPEC and those producers halfway around the world that do that. Of course, that benefits Vladimir Putin as the energy price rises. Again, another consequence, too, of the devalued dollars, the dollar devalues. It takes more dollars to buy the same amount of oil. Now, you asked how we thought about the Russia threat during the Trump administration. We were very clear that we thought that we could cooperate with Russia in certain areas in ways that we couldn't with adversaries like Communist China, but we had to do so from a position of strength. And so it's no coincidence that Putin did not try these kinds of provocations when you had Trump in office, because we had unleashed our energy supplies. We had sanctioned him. We had sent defensive weaponry to Ukraine. We were taking steps to make very clear that there would be real consequences if he tried any funny business. And so he didn't. And now, unfortunately, you're seeing a reversal because he sees weakness. And that doesn't take any great genius, John. He sees, you know, the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the slide back into dialogue with Beijing and us ignoring North Korea and pulling back on our relationships in the Middle East, for instance, saying we weren't going to help Saudi Arabia and their conflict with the Iran-backed Houthi rebels, downgrading the labeling of terrorist organizations like the Houthis, saying they're no longer terrorists when they actually are. He sees all of this. And so it's not just one thing or one signal. It's the combination of all of these things that Putin has understood, internalized, and now is trying to take advantage of.
Two voices from Europe. First, Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO. This is within these hours. Stoltenberg tells reporters Russia should, quote, de-escalate, and any further aggression will come with a high cost for Moscow, adding that NATO was a defensive alliance which does not threaten Russia or any other country. More significantly, however, is the discussion of Nord Stream 2 being used as leverage. We have this from Olaf Scholz, the Chancellor of the Germans. Quote, it is clear that there will be a high price to pay and that everything will have to be discussed should there be a military intervention in Ukraine. The Europeans are promising to talk, Mary. They're going to talk among their membership, a membership that right now is chilly, and it can get a lot worse. This does not tell me that there's been planning for these days, Mary. It tells me that they're spontaneously responding to questions from the media. Where was Olaf Scholz's Russia policy in the event of an invasion of Ukraine?
Well, Olaf Scholz is a new chancellor. His party, the SPD, has been pro-Moscow for many, many decades. The Germans don't want to upset the Russians. They have business interests there and political ties. But simultaneously, John, neither do the French, the Spaniards, or the Italians. So the Biden administration is not just dealing with a Putin that sees us on the back foot. They're also dealing with Western Europeans who don't really want to do anything here. So it's a complicated situation, and it calls for strong American leadership. We had similar issues with the Europeans. This isn't new. It's not a new dynamic. We had it even with Merkel as chancellor. But it's something that has to be addressed, and we have to look at it realistically and say, okay, if they're not going to do anything and we think that their security is threatened and that they need to take on more responsibility for their own security, what's the leverage here? How are we going to make them do it? Is it in our interest to do it? These are the hard questions that need to be asked.
Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President, Stevens Incorporated, former Senior Advisor to the Secretary of State. We're headed to Hong Kong. Mary was many years in Hong Kong, and there's not good news. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.